So we're going to be joined by two speakers. Our primary speaker today will be Craig Patterson, who's coming from EPA's Office of Research and Development in their National Risk Management Research Laboratory. Craig is currently an environmental engineer in the U.S. EPA's Water Systems Division, conducting drinking water research studies in Cincinnati, Ohio. Craig's EPA research has focused on small drinking water treatment technologies, including filtration, point of entry, point of use devices, advanced oxidation and disinfection processes. He received his Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering and a Master of Science in Environmental Engineering from the University of Cincinnati. And prior to joining EPA in 2003, Craig worked as a project engineer for environmental consulting firms for 20 years. He's also a professional engineer in the state of Ohio. Before we launch into Craig's presentation, we're going to be joined by Steve Diamant, who is a Superfund and Technology Liaison for EPA's Office of Research and Development in their EPA Region 8 office, to provide some background on today's project. So I'm going to go ahead and transition our arrangements here, and hopefully we can now see Steve's screen in real time. Steve, I just wanted to let you know we can see that map live, and I'll turn things over to Steve to start with that introduction.
Great. Thanks so much, Jean. Again, I'm Steve Diamant. I'm the Superfund and Technology Liaison for EPA's Office of Research and Development in Region 8. And among some of the things we do are direct tech support for Superfund sites and water program sites, brownfields, and other types of sites. We also focus on regional research, and that's the subject of today's talk. And we also work to connect the expertise that the Office of Research and Development has in its technical support centers and laboratories to bring that expertise to bear on EPA regional projects, research needs, also working closely with our state, tribal, and local partners. So, as Jean mentioned today, we'll be talking about our a rare project, a regional applied research effort project we conducted in 2017. And finishing up in 2018 on the effectiveness of point-of-entry systems to remove select fur and polyfluoral alkyl substances from drinking water. Go back in time, if you will, to around 2015. At this time, you may recall that EPA's drinking water program and the UCMR, the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, results are starting to come out. In particular, six PFAS compounds were in that group, and we began to get our arms around some of the challenges that we face as a nation in terms of the frequency of occurrence of some of those compounds and the distribution of some of that contamination. Around this same time in 2015, 2016, in part as a result of some of the sampling that took place through UCMR3, the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, we also began to get detections of PFAS compounds south of Colorado Springs in the Security Wide-Field Aquifer. At the time, EPA was heavily involved. We had an on-scene coordinator there. Our state partners, Colorado Department of Health and Environment, were also there, and other folks involved. If you take a look at the map here, it gives you some idea, just south of Colorado Springs, the area of impact, and it follows this Fountain Creek watershed, if you will. To the north are the Colorado Springs Municipal Airport and also, of note, Peterson's Air Force Base, where we think a lot of the foams and things were used. So it's a relatively large area. And at the time, residents were given options of receiving bottled water. Surface water was being pumped up from south of there to Pueblo, Colorado, about 30 miles away. Surface water was blended with some of those impacted systems. And also, we began to explore ideas for treatment. So we had involvement from EPA, state, Air Force, and others. Enter our 2016 RARE proposal, working closely with our regional and state partners. And we looked at previous work on point-of-use systems. There had been some studies done in the state of Michigan looking at point-of-use systems. Those are small systems, you know, gallons, small-gallon systems right at the sink itself. For effectiveness of removal of some of these PFAS compounds. And around that same time, 2016, the National Sanitation Foundation was also developing their standard for POU or point-of-use system treatment options, including activated carbon systems, reverse osmosis, and others. As all of this sampling and delineation is playing out at the site, we're looking into options for mitigation of the current problems, potential treatment, and even down the horizon towards remediation. as all this played out, we were getting questions from folks concerned about how do I protect myself now? How do I limit all my exposures from these PFAS compounds, which we know are in the systems? So we turned our focus to our 2017 Regional Applied Research Effort Project of Effectiveness of Point of Entry Systems to Remove Select Per- and Polyfluoroalkyl Substances from Drinking Water. So here we're looking at entry systems. These are whole house systems, larger systems, which Craig will talk about in a minute, generally looking at commercially available technologies like granular activated carbon, reverse osmosis, and to some extent even anion exchange resins, which around the 2017 timeframe began to pop up in some of the as potential treatment options, as well as activated carbon for the larger municipal systems, which were beginning to come online as well. Now enter Craig Patterson. Gene introduced Craig a minute ago. Craig's an engineer with ORD's National Risk Management Research Lab in Cincinnati at the Test and Evaluation Center. And we teamed up with Craig to get access to that Test and Evaluation Center, the 5,000-gallon tank, and all of the facilities that Craig has at his disposal. And the idea was to look at six of the previously identified PFAS compounds which had been found in the aquifer, the wide field security aquifer area, and look at commercially available activated carbon and reverse osmosis systems and the potential performance for those for point of entry larger home systems. So here we are now, fast forward to 2018. We have our, I'll switch to take a look here. The two things I wanted to mention in terms of information about what's currently going on are both the Colorado Department of Health and Environment website and also the El Paso County website, but they do have interactive maps, which I'm showing here. You can see some of the impacted communities, those areas with the S's are Strathmore Hills, F is Fountain, W are the Whitefield areas, Fountain areas as well. So we've got a number of municipalities, Security, Whitefield, Fountain, and Strathmore Hills, which are currently dealing with some of those issues. In fact, we had an August community engagement EPA event down there in Colorado Springs where we heard testimonials from residents. We saw presentations from various activist groups. We got presentations from the various municipalities on their current treatment efforts and going forward and how they're going to be treating some of the groundwater here. Suffice to say that initially a lot of it was either treated to non-detect or blended with surface water to be well below EPA's health advisory of 70 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFAS combined. And so now we're into 2018, and we've got our results. We're going to have some publications coming up and potential follow-up in terms of additional research, and I'll let Craig touch on all of that. So with that, I'll turn it over to our main speaker, Craig Patterson. Craig, take it away. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. I'm waiting for my screen to come up.
And Craig, just letting you know, we can see your content. You can go into that slideshow mode.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to recognize my co-authors. Jonathan Burkhart with US EPA Office of Research and Development in Cincinnati, Ohio. He provided the modeling for the studies. Steve Diamond and Stephen Merritt. Stephen Merritt is with US EPA Region 8 in Denver, Colorado. You just heard from Steve Diamond. Also Larry Zintek and Daniel Kleinmeier with US EPA Region 5 Chicago Regional Laboratory in Illinois. They provided the PFAS analysis, and Radha Krishnan and Don Shoup with Aptum, an extramural contractor in Cincinnati, Ohio, who assisted EPA with the study. You can see the extent of contamination, which Steve Diamond had just shown you, on the Fountain Creek watershed and then the Whitefield aquifers within the Fountain Creek watershed. As Steve mentioned, the aqueous film-forming foam was used to fight fires at Peterson Air Force Base In August 2016, a new product, FosCheck, with shorter chain molecules is now being used. The six UCMR3 PFAS were detected in the wide-field aquifer with potential health impacts of cancer, liver, thyroid, pancreatic, kidney, and fertility problems. Also, initially, the surface water was being blended from the Pueblo Reservoir to meet the health advisory. There was also some PCE contamination in the aquifer. Bottled water stations were set up for residents, and water coolers were installed in homes to provide drinking water sources to residents living in the wide-field aquifer region. These options are temporary. You can see residents filling their gallon containers and using the water coolers, but this requires a lot of effort by the residents to physically go to the water stations and have these 5-gallon coolers delivered. So the thought is we should come up with some treatment options for these households, which spurred on this research. So we wanted to assess the removal effectiveness of PFAS using commercially available reverse osmosis and granular activated carbon absorption systems for homes with private wells in the wide-field aquifer. EPA purchased commercially available water systems and conducted treatability studies on representative test waters. You can, for those who don't know, the point of use is actually at the kitchen sink. It's mounted under the sink, or end of faucet or pour-through devices are used, whereas point of entry systems or whole house systems typically installed in a hot water tank room or in a heated garage. So the project also documented ease of use during installation, startup, continuous intermittent operation based on manufacturer's instructions, and also looked at operation and maintenance schedules for replacement of RO units and GAC media. The picture on the right in slide 6, you can see the components as delivered for the reverse osmosis systems for installation, and the photo on the bottom is a representative carbon tank with pre- and post-sediment filters. We chose to use the NSF standard P473. This is was a draft in 2016. They only looked at carbon-based and reverse osmosis treatment systems for removal below the EPA health advisory level of 70 parts per trillion. The standard adds 1.5 micrograms per liter of a combination of 1 microgram PFAS and 0.5 micrograms PFOA, and determines if the treatment system can remove the PFAS down to a 70 part per trillion level. The water treatment systems, including water filters, must verify that the contaminant reduction claims for PFOA and PFAS shown on the label are true. The system does not add anything harmful to the water. The system is structurally sound. The product labeling, advertising, and literature are not misleading. We went to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment website. As you see here on slide 8, the maximum concentrations we found from all the UCMR3 sampling and analysis between 2013 and 2016. And we also looked at the average PFAS concentration. The UCMR3 PFAS contaminants, 4 that are longer chain, and then there are 2 shorter chain. You can see the carbon chain length of C6 and C4 for the PFHXS and the PFBS. We also upped the PFOA feed concentration from 200 to 800 parts per trillion to keep the ratio, the P473 ratio of 2-to-1 PFAS to PFOA for the representative test water. We looked at the wide-field aquifer water quality between 1992 and 2016 to see if any of the parameters would actually impact GAC media or reverse osmosis membranes. We combined those results with the P473 requirements and ended up with the with the list shown on slide 11. For RO, we're looking at 25 degrees C. For GAC, 20 degrees C. We added TOC to the GOC test water to greater than 1 milligram per liter as dehydrated natural organic matter. We added TDS to both the RO and GAC feed waters to 500 milligrams per liter. And then we added 300 milligrams per liter of hardness to the RO test water at CaCO3 using the salts shown on slide 11. Our sample collection, handling, and preservation. As I mentioned, Chicago Regional Laboratory did the analysis. It's an LC-MS-MS standard operating procedure that has a holding time of 28 days. We provided 15 ml polypropylene containers and triplicate for the analyses. We also did a lot of the water quality parameters at the test and evaluation facility in Cincinnati, Ohio for the TOC, TDS, turbidity, and hardness, and we analyzed for free chlorine, pH, and temperature immediately. This slide on slide 13 shows our feed water results. On the left side of the slide, you can see the 5,000-gallon tank at the test and evaluation facility, and then the 55-gallon drum used for the GAC study. We did a stability test before the actual test to see if we were within range for our part per trillion PFAS contaminant levels. Fortunately, we did. Our PFAS calculation was off. It was only 10% of what was required, and the PFBS came in as non-detect. So we changed the calculations, found a new source for the PFBS, and our feed water concentrations were within range of our target concentration. We did the same for the water quality results for the TDS and the hardness on the RO test water quality, and then the TDS and the TOC for the GAC test water quality. On slide 15, you can see the three commercially available systems we tested, the RO systems, the iSpring on the left, the Hydrologic Evolution in the center, and then the Flexion RO system on the right. These are really between point of use and point of entry, ranging in flow from 0.35 gallons per minute to 0.7 gallons per minute. And I just wanted to point out some of the RO system specifications on slide 16. The iSpring RO system had three pre-filters and one post-filter. In addition to the RO membrane, the Hydrologic Evolution had one pre-filter with two RO membranes, and the Flexion had two pre-filters and one post-filter with two RO membranes. One of the issues with RO systems are they create a lot of wastewater or reject water coming off the RO system. As you can see, half of the water that was used for treatment went away as wastewater to either a septic system or a sewer if it's available. And the Flexion actually had 62% of the water that was actually wastewater. So this may be an issue if you have a limited supply of well water. The iSpring RO system had a booster pump, and we had to purchase a booster pump for the Hydrologic Evolution and the Flexion RO system. On slide 17, have recorded what the manufacturers recommend for replacement of pre-filters. And for the RO membranes, you can see the filters are anywhere from 3 to 12 months for replacement. And they typically range in cost from $10 to $50 each. And the RO membranes are replaced anywhere from 6 to 24 months. And these RO membranes typically cost $100 to $150 each. Of course, all this is dependent on the water quality. This is our reverse osmosis test unit. We used the 5,000-gallon tank with a heat exchanger tied to a chiller to control temperature. You can see we sampled prior to the RO system, and then coming from the permeate or clean water line coming off the RO system. We chose to use the P473 sampling plan, which is a 7-day sampling plan with a 2-day stagnation period over the weekend to look at shutdown and startup impacts. So we're sampling between anywhere from 4 to 6 hours for 5 days. And then we would ship the samples to Chicago for analysis within the 28-day holding time. The results for the iSpring RO system, all effluent results were non-detect. None of the 6 UCMR3 chemicals came through. For the PFAS hydrologic evolution system, we did have 6 of the 42 PFAS results were greater than non-detect. And most of these were right after shutdown and startup on day 7. You can see the results here that were above non-detect. Most of them are greater than 90% removal. However, on day 7, the PFAS plus PFOA exceeded the 70 part per trillion EPA health advisory level. And for the Flexion results, you can see all PFAS results were non-detect. The second part of the study was the GAC media study. We chose to use a rapid small-scale column test so that we could look at breakthrough of the PFAS. We took 55 gallons from the 5,000-gallon mixed tank. We sampled prior to a carbon column, which is 3/8 inch in diameter by 6 inches long, and then after the carbon column. We chose to sample every 30 minutes for 8 hours. And these are the two carbons we used. One was a coconut-based carbon by Evoqua, and the second was a bituminous coal-based carbon by Calgon. We used a 10-minute empty bed contact time as recommended by the manufacturers. And the process for the rapid small-scale column test is to actually grind the carbon down to a smaller size, going from 12 by 30 mesh and 12 by 40 mesh to 170 by 200 mesh. You sieve the carbon, get the smaller size, and look at breakthrough, and then scale that up for full-time breakthrough removal. And this, on slide 27, you can see the Evoqua coconut-based carbon for the PFAS plus PFOA health advisory. The carbon broke through in about 4 hours. And the PFBS, the shorter chain molecule, broke through at about 6 hours. For the bituminous coal-based carbon, the PFAS plus PFOA broke through a little sooner at 3 hours, and the PFBS actually lasts a little bit longer at about 7.5 hours before breakthrough. So after looking at the worst case, PFAS concentration, influent concentrations, we decided to use the ad design model from Michigan Tech University to predict the GAC lifetime based on the average PFOA and PFAS concentrations based on the historic records from 2013 to 2016. And the PFAS plus PFOA concentration in the influent was approximately 3,000 parts per trillion for the worst case scenario and 180 nanograms per liter for the average day, which is a 16 to 17 times reduction. For the maximum day, the model predicted an exceedance of 70 parts per trillion at about 3,400 bed volumes for the Evoqua coconut base and 2,700 bed volumes for the Calgon bituminous coal base, which is consistent with our experimental values. So looking at the modeled results, you can see the breakthrough of the maximum day in green and the breakthrough of the average day in blue. And the the maximum day only lasted 24 days of operation, whereas the average day actually lasted 2.2 years of operation for the coconut-based carbon. Similarly, the bituminous-based carbon had lasted 19 days of operation for the worst case and 1.5 years of operation for the average day case. Now we're going to switch gears here and explain how an RO system might be installed in a household. You can see the booster pump that we purchased for the Hydrologic Evolution RO system. Because it takes about 1.5 gallons per minute to shower, and these systems range in flow rate between 0.35 and 7.7 gallons per minute, you would need a storage tank to hold the water to provide enough supply for the household. So for a two-bedroom household, you'd need a 200-gallon tank, and for a four-bedroom, you'd need about a 400-gallon tank that would have to be installed in your hot water tank room or heated garage. Another aspect of RO systems, they may require a remineralization cartridge because the RO removes the minerals from the well water, and that can change the aggressiveness of the water in the household. So mineralization cartridges would provide minerals and soften the water back to avoid any issues with your household plumbing. So we're looking at $2,000 before installation for the RO system. Here's a typical 4 to 5 gallon per minute non-backwashing whole house carbon filter on slide 33 with the 5 and 1 micron pleated sediment cartridges. The issue with PFAS removal for carbon is the empty bed contact time. Instead of using 1 cubic foot of carbon for a taste and odor control household carbon water filter, you're looking at 8 cubic feet of carbon and a backwashing carbon lead lag tank. So you're talking a lot more carbon, which is logistically an issue working in someone's basement. So another issue is you'd have to restrict the well water flow to 5 gallons per minute to get the empty bay contact time. So in this case, you're looking at $4,000 before installation and quite a bit of weight. Another thought was to restrict the flow further to 0.5 gallons per minute, much like the RO systems, and go back to a water storage tank. In this case, you have to change the GAC out more often, but it's more manageable. You're talking about a lot of contaminated carbon media. And again, you need a pump to actually boost the pressure in the household after the water storage tank. So in this case, you're looking at $1,200 before installation. So in summary, the large GAC adsorption system has high capital and high maintenance costs. The small GAC system has moderate capital and high maintenance costs, and the RO system has moderate capital and maintenance costs. The large GAC system has a large footprint and heavy components. The small GAC has a large footprint and awkward components, and then the RO system has a large footprint and awkward components. The large GAC system has higher flow rate, 4 to 5 gallon per minute, but no water storage tank is required. For both the small GAC and the RO system, you need a water storage tank. A large GAC adsorption system requires backwash, wastewater lines, and periodic carbon replacement. The small GAC system has fewer connections but requires more frequent carbon replacement. And the RO system requires high system pressure, reject, wastewater lines, and periodic membrane replacement. Other issues for the GAC adsorption system. There's issues with the logistical cost and safety of carbon replacement. The RO system has issues with sanitizing components and replacing cartridges and tubing. The GAC system actually has less impact on the cold water temperature and the flow through carbon tanks, whereas the RO system residents may complain about the cold water temperature at room temperature in the water storage tank. So in other words, the water coming out of the tap is going to be at room temperature instead of being cold. The GAC absorption system may not be effective on short-chain PFAS, whereas the RO system treats both long and short-chain PFAS. And then the GAC absorption system could experience contaminant breakthrough if the carbon changeout schedule is not followed, whereas the RO system is less likely to have contaminant breakthrough even if scheduled maintenance is not performed. However, corrosion control and household plumbing may be an issue for the point of entry RO system. So in conclusion, the three RO systems tested successfully removed PFAS from the influent water to below analytical detection for a majority of the sampling events. However, long-term performance of the membrane systems was not tested. We only went for 7 days with the RO system. The RSS, or rapid small-scale column test data, estimated the coal-based carbon to have a lifetime of 20 days with the coconut-based carbon lifetime at 33 days based on the worst case PFAS concentrations found in the wide field aquifer before exceeding the 70 part per trillion health advisory level. Modeling the results for lower concentrations gave bed lives of 1.5 years for the bituminous coal-based carbon and 2.2 years for the coconut-based carbon. However, additional pilot tests should be performed to ensure the use of best performing GAC for each application. Other conclusions: if properly designed based on source water characteristics, household water systems can provide relatively inexpensive treatment barriers for PFAS removal in the home. Analysis of PFAS samples is costly for homeowners, typically $200 per sample, and can be a major hurdle in effective removal of PFAS from household water supplies. Proper operation and maintenance and conservative replacement of the RO components and GAC media may be one way to circumvent the high cost of monitoring treated household drinking water. This is the EPA disclaimer. It says any endorsement of commercially available systems any endorsement of commercially available products should not be considered by EPA. Are there any questions?
Well, actually, thank you, Craig. We do have a series of questions that have already been submitted into the Q&A window. So I'll have you leave your slides up there in case people are referencing a particular slide in your talk. And I'll remind the live audience that if you have questions for Craig or for Steve on this particular project, you can type them into the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You can go ahead and type in messages into the empty box all the way at the very bottom, and then we'll start reading through those questions so that our speakers can address them. This first question, Craig, came in reference to slide number 11. And this participant wants to know, why was the water adjusted?
Okay, yeah. The NSF standard is actually designed to determine if these household treatment devices are effective for contaminant removal. What they do is they look at, you know, what are the worst case situations where, you might have a water quality that could impact a reverse osmosis system or a GAC media. So, for instance, you know, RO membranes, they have a little bit higher temperature than the GAC because the seals on the RO membrane may be impacted by temperature. And then, you know, the RO membrane, the hardness can actually impact the lifetime of the RO membrane as well as the, you know, the impact of the total dissolved solids on the RO and the GAC. And then the TOC also can compete on the GAC media.
Okay, excellent. Our next question gets into your analytic confidence interval. And they'd like to know, what is the analytic confidence interval for the 0.07 micrograms per liter?
Okay, yeah, we use the standard operating procedure in the Chicago Regional Laboratory. The method detection limit for all of the six UCMR3 PFAS contaminants were less than 3 parts per trillion. So they're detecting, you know, all six of those at less than 3 parts per trillion. So as far as the confidence interval, you know, we're going to actually have, we've submitted a journal article that will provide more detailed information on that. But, you know, the method itself is pretty robust down to the 3 part per trillion level.
Okay. We have a number of questions about the RO systems. So I'm going to sort of jump into those RO questions. And the first one asks, does the RO wastewater contain PFAS compounds?
Yes, it does. You're more or less concentrating any contaminants and minerals in the water into the wastewater for a reverse osmosis system. I know there's a lot of concern about the liability issues with putting PFAS back into the environment. You know, if you're looking in a well water, you may be pulling the PFAS out and sending it to a septic system at the home, or, you know, if the sewer is available, sending it to the sewer. I guess at this point, the regulations aren't clear on, you know, the fate of the PFAS, but regardless, if it does go to the septic system and you're still pulling groundwater, and some of that PFAS would get back into the groundwater, you would again have your point of entry system to treat the PFAS. But that's a difficult question, and I appreciate that question. Thank you.
Okay. And so I believe that you've addressed the questions, because a number of people were writing in exactly on that, that they want to know how exactly would you be dealing with that waste stream that is typically associated with an RO system. And so when you have that rejected water contaminated with PFAS, what do you do with it? So we've addressed that question, so thanks very much for that. Let's look at another element. For RO systems with a separate waste stream, can you confirm that the concentrations in there were even higher, and can you talk about what you did with that water? And they're talking specifically in your tests.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, the test and evaluation facility is on the grounds of the Metropolitan Sewer District in Cincinnati, Ohio. The treatment, the wastewater treatment for all of Cincinnati goes to the wastewater treatment plant. So the reverse osmosis wastewater went directly into the wastewater treatment system. And as far as the carbon, you know, it would actually be absorbed by the carbon. You're talking about a 3/8-inch diameter by 6-inch carbon column. So it's not much contaminated carbon for the actual GAC media studies.
Okay. And this other question, I think they're actually asking in terms of the laboratory or the testing procedures, but the question was asked, how was the 62% influent water to the RO system that became wastewater managed? I don't know if they're talking about, again, that waste stream, or if they're talking about the influent water that ultimately turned into a waste stream. How did you handle the influent water?
Okay, yeah, you know, we took our samples before and after. The actual, you know, again, the wastewater from the RO system went to the wastewater treatment plant at the city of Cincinnati. You know, for the GAC, you know, that PFAS adheres to the carbon, so it does not, you know, all we measured coming off of there was the clean water. All the PFAS were retained on the, well, that's not completely true. Yes, some, after breakthrough, some did actually go to the sewage treatment plant.
Okay. Okay, can you talk exactly where the clean water for the RO system comes from if you have a contaminated water supply?
Yeah, the RO, it's reverse osmosis is actually a spiral wound membrane where you force the water through under pressure, and the clean water permeates through the membrane, and the dirty water goes across the membrane. So you're actually using pressure to force the clean water through the membrane, and that rejects all of the PFAS contaminants that pass through with the wastewater portion of the reverse osmosis membrane. There were other, you know, options for these commercially available systems where they, some of them had carbon pre-filters that may have also been doing some of the heavy lifting for the PFAS removal. You know, a lot of these have, as I mentioned in the presentation, they have more than one pre-filter that may also be doing some of the removal.
Okay. Can you answer this question? Were the RO treatment units tested with the pre- and post-carbon filters? And then there's a follow-up.
They were.
They were, okay. And so
yeah,
they
the reason I, you know, obviously you want to look at what is the RO membrane doing, but in our case, we're doing this to support the residents of Colorado. So we just took these commercially available systems off the shelf from, you know, any given website, you know, for purchase, and tested them as is, before and after. We did not look at, you know, what did the carbon pre-filter remove versus the RO membrane. It was just a snapshot before and after.
Okay, and that's sort of what they were asking with their follow-on. If so, do you have confidence that the RO membrane was effective in removing the PFAS and, in, for example, not the pre- and post-carbon filters?
Well, in the one case, some of the, you know, PFAS were detected. And, you know, to be fair, we're only testing one system. You know, ideally, you would test a number of these systems from the same manufacturer to look at, you know, was one of the RO membrane compromised, you know, during manufacture, you know. So there are a lot of variables with, you know, with the funding and the timeline to get this information out to the public. We chose just to do one system. But ideally, we would do additional research on different membranes, you know, manufactured at different times to look at how well, you know, the RO membranes actually remove the PFAS.
Okay. And again, I think we've addressed this, but just to confirm, people really want to know if there was a GAC pre-filter in the RO, how do you know that the PFAS didn't get treated by the GAC?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. And I just mentioned that, you know, we just tested before and after, so yeah, some of it may have been removed by the RO membrane, some of it may have been removed by the GAC filters, but we did not go to that level of detail in our research study.
Okay, so now we're going to try some questions, kind of shifting gears a little bit with the granular activated carbon. I take that back. Let's just clarify. Did you evaluate the relative removal by carbon pre- and post-filters versus the RO membranes?
I'm sorry. Now, what were you asking me?
We were just hitting on this. They want to know specifically, did you evaluate that relative removal by carbon in the pre- and post-filters versus the RO membranes?
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's the same question. I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the actual rapid small-scale column test. No, we didn't look at how much the carbon removed and how much the RO membrane removed. We just looked at what both of them removed.
Okay. Someone would like to know if you can essentially, sorry, bear with me. So what did you do with the spent carbon from the carbon filters?
Those went out as, well, I'm not sure, actually. I believe they went out as solid waste. I don't, you know, it's not a regulated contaminant. My guess is that it went out as solid waste to a landfill.
Okay. And can you comment what the empty bed contact time was for those GAC systems?
Yeah, they were 10-minute empty bed contact time for the GAC media. And, you know, when you're talking about a lead-like situation, you're doubling that if you were to actually install it in the home. So it would be a 20-minute, if you had two carbon tanks at 10 minutes each, you'd end up with a 20-minute empty bed contact time.
Okay. Someone wants to know, what is it about coconut that makes it a good treatment option over GAC?
Well, I think, you know, there are different pore sizes when you compare bituminous coal and coconut. There are actually fewer pores in the coconut base. You know, I'm not going to speculate on why the coconut-based carbon did better, but the modeling supported that the carbon would last, or the coconut-based carbon would last longer than the bituminous-based carbon, and that's how our research study the results turned well.
Okay, one of the participants wants to know, why exactly was the Calgon F600 selected for the test? They go on to say that they're understanding that a different unit is Calgon's F400 is the standard unit for this type of PFAS removal. And they just referenced an article that came out in a scientific publication indicating also that coal GAC had actually outperformed the coconut-based GAC for PFAS.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what, you know, which PFAS contaminant you're talking about is outperforming. Like the, you know, in our case, the shorter chain, the you know, bituminous-based carbon actually did better than the coconut base for the PFBS, whereas for the PFOS and PFOA, the, you know, the coconut-based carbon did was more effective for removal. And as far as the issue with the F400, that's typically used at the municipal treatment plants. You know, we worked with Calgon Carbon on what did they recommend for point-of-use, point-of-entry devices, and the F600 was what they recommended that we evaluate.
Okay. We did have a number of questions about the municipal treatment, so I'll come back to that in just a moment. But we did have someone who wants you to go back and restate the effectiveness on the removal of the short-change PFCs.
Okay. All right. So the part of the issue with all these studies, and it's something to consider. If you look at a well water, you're going to and a PFAS plume, you're going to have different concentrations of different PFAS contaminants for a given location. So what we did was we pulled all the results from the Colorado Department of Health and Environment and looked at the worst case situation. So in other words, like, we weren't starting with all the same concentrations of all PFAS contaminants. They varied. If you look at the back at some of the earlier slides, this slide here. So you can see for the shorter chain, the PFBS and PFHXS, these were much lower, well, at least the PFBS was much lower than what was found in, for the maximum PFOS. So you're starting with, this is actually what we studied. You know, we evaluated the maximum concentration, and these are varying, you know, PFOS concentration levels. So when you actually get to your breakthrough curve, you're not all starting with the same PFOS concentration. So some of them are going to come out and break through sooner than others. Going back to these curves. So for instance, the PFBS, which is the purple line right here, broke through at 6 hours for the coconut base, and then you go to the carbon base, and it broke through way over here at 7.5 hours. So it lasted an hour and a half longer. So, you know, but again, there were a lot more higher concentrations of PFOS and PFOA in our test water than the PFBS itself. I don't know if that explains it. I hope so.
Okay, great. Thank you. Someone is asking, for the GAC RSSCT, did you grind to a particular reduction size where the column diameter was 20 times greater or 50 times greater than the GAC particle diameter?
Yeah, we went to, you know, to the 170 by 200 mesh, and again, Evokawa and Calgon recommended that for the rapid small-scale column test. So we ground the carbon with the mortar and pestle and then put it through sieves to get the 170 by 200 mesh that actually went into the carbon column, the 3/8 by 6 inch long stainless steel tube.
Okay. I'm going to switch gears here to some more analytical based questions. Someone wants to know if you did any analysis of how hardness and pH may affect the efficiency of PFAS treatment.
We didn't. You know, we chose to, you know, set up a water quality parameters based on the, you know, the P473 NSF standard and also the water quality in the aquifer. So we did not look at the impact of pH or hardness on the removal. Again, all this, you know, begs for more research. I think there are a lot of areas here that we could do a lot more research, including on resins, you know, anti-exchange resin removal, which seems to be working very well for PFAS removal, but I think that will be future research down the road.
Okay. Someone has a question about the tabulated data for aquifer, WQ, or water quality. They don't recognize the units for phosphate. It looks like it's milligram, P, and then a slash H. Could you just confirm what units you had in that aquifer water quality table for phosphate?
Sure. Okay, phosphate, phosphorus. Yeah, that doesn't look right. Milligrams. I have that person email me, and I'll get back with them on that.
Okay. All right. So was sorry, I'm going to bounce back here to a question. Can you speculate on the presence of VOCs in your feed water and how that might have an effect on sorption and possible desorption of the PFCs?
Yeah, I guess the PCE, you know, they mentioned the PCE being an issue. I'd have to think that one through. Have that person email me also.
Okay. So let's circle back to what the local municipalities are doing. A number of people have asked what if treatment is in place at the local municipalities, and if so, what are they doing to deal with PFAS in the water?
All right, want me to take that one, Craig?
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
So I was at the community engagement events this past August, and all of the municipalities that are currently impacted, Security, Widefield, Fountain, and Strathmore Hills, all the presentations on what they're currently doing. Most of all of them, if they're using groundwater from the impacted aquifer, are treating with either activated carbon or anion exchange resins to non-detect. And they may still be blending surface water from Pueblo Reservoir or bringing surface water up from Pueblo Reservoir as another way to augment. So at peak demand, the surface water from Pueblo Reservoir may not be able to cover all of their needs. They're going to start pumping in those aquifer materials, and where they are treating with either activated municipal systems that are online for activated, that are either using activated carbon or anion exchange resins. I believe it was two systems that I saw were using anion exchange resins, and two systems were using activated carbon systems. So I think they're all either exploring or expanding their the current treatment, but all of that groundwater shown in the map there, that those four municipalities are currently using for groundwater are treating to non-detect, I believe, for the six UCMR3 compounds mentioned.
Okay. And can you just expand a little bit on that surface water blending that's being used as an interim measure? So is it's happening at a facility and people go to get the blended water, or is that blending happening within the municipal treatment systems?
Well, my understanding, again, from some of the presentations during the community engagement event was that to the extent possible, they are using surface water to meet demands. But during peak demands, the amount of surface water they can bring in isn't sufficient, in which case they are blending with treated groundwater, either using the activated carbon or anion exchange resin systems.
Okay. Craig, I think this question goes back to you. Is calcium sulfate necessary for the removal of PFAS-PFOA? They say that calcium sulfate acts like a precipitation aid in the RO systems, and so they want to know, has the RO method been tested without hardness?
Are you talking, I guess, let me go over to this slide here. Okay, the calcium sulfate was actually used to boost the hardness in the test water. It's not necessary to all these are just water quality parameters that are put in place to challenge the RO membrane. So we're upping the hardness to 300 milligrams per liter as CaCO3, and we're using those salts, potassium chloride, magnesium sulfate, and sodium bicarbonate, and calcium sulfate to get the hardness in the water for the representative test water. So no, it's not necessary to remove the PFAS, but it's more of a challenge parameter for the RO membrane.
Okay. Did you ever develop an explanation of why the post-stagnation RO results would have exceeded the health advisory level?
Well, again, it's difficult to speculate. The membrane seal may not have been perfect. The hydrologic evolution only had one carbon pre-filter. There are a whole bunch of different issues you may, want to look into further if you were going to do some more research. But I think this requires more research to have a definitive answer.
Okay. Could you answer what type of analytical method was used that calls for the 15 mil sample aliquot and it gets 3 ppd LOD?
Yeah, it's an LC-MS-MS procedure. You know, I would have to defer to the researchers at the Chicago Regional Laboratory. You know, they've had the method certified. If you want information on that, I can also provide whoever asked that question with the standard operating procedure if they email me. So I think that would be the best way to handle that question.
Okay. All right, and just a quick reminder, if you happen to be one of the individuals who's been suggested to contact Craig or Steve after the broadcast, we'll remind everyone how you can find their contact information before we close out today. So with that, let me come back to some of the questions that are still in the queue. So Steve, you mentioned earlier that a resin system is being used for PFC removal at the municipal level. And they were just curious if a resin system could also be used as a POE system.
Well, in terms of using it as a POE system, I think that's something that Craig and I are very interested in for future research. So I don't have all the specifics, but the folks that have the municipal system at the wide field aquifer, to my knowledge, I saw a presentation on it a while back. I think it was in 2016 or 2017, became the first municipal system in the U.S. treating PFAS with anion exchange resins. And, in fact, the performance data I saw showed that the anion exchange resins were doing, as Craig mentioned, you know, current research is showing the performance of some of those anion exchange resins. They're doing quite well. I think it had a 5 times greater adsorption capacity versus activated carbon and greater than a 2 times hydraulic capacity, so you could put more water through it and absorb 5 times the amount of contaminant mass onto the anion exchange resins. I would encourage folks to reach out to the folks at the Wide Field Aquifer. I only saw their presentation that they gave with a lot of that data, but I know much of that information is online, so there is a municipal system utilizing anion exchange resins for treatment in Y-field.
Okay. Are you familiar with any other technologies that could be used to treat PFAS at, like, a large scale?
I think the research is going full bore right now. Everybody's looking at a whole variety of things, so I'm not sure if the question is focused towards removal and actual treatment, because really, as Craig mentioned, one of the things we can do successfully now is sorb it. So we can sorb it, we can concentrate the PFAS materials through an RO system, we can sorb them onto media like anion exchange resins and activated carbons, but the technology is going forward and actually, you know, destructing the compounds. The research is ongoing there, and in particular some of the in situ methods. I think there's some interesting research on the horizon, but currently, you know, in terms of tried and true methods and what's out there, to my knowledge, most of it is sorption type technologies. But I do believe in the next 5 to 10 years that we will have other technologies at our disposal, some that might be able to be utilized in situ or within aquifers or as part of a treatment train for a pump and treat system for a municipal system.
Okay. So I have another sort of grouping of questions here that are circling around cost. I'm going to try to go through these, although many of them are clustered together or they kind of come in different groupings here. One group of questions is looking at the energy costs. So did you look at the energy costs to operate RO versus the GAC systems?
Yeah, I guess that falls back on me. I did not look at the energy costs, but obviously with the RO, you're talking about a booster pump, and then you're also talking about a pump to increase the pressure in the household. So that in itself points at a lot higher energy costs. However, you know, these are 110 volt, you know, plugs. These aren't, you know, these household systems are, you just plug it into any electrical outlet. It's not like you need a lot of electricity to run these. So yeah, I would, the RO would be more expensive on the energy side. The carbon, it would just be, you could use your well water pump to push the water through the carbon tanks and go directly into the household.
Okay. And so what about construction costs? Did you look at the average construction cost for each unit?
You mean as far as someone actually installing it? We did not.
Okay. Did you look at the annual costs for maintaining the system? So not just the energy, but perhaps periodic costs like replacing cartridges?
Yeah, as I mentioned in the presentation, let's see, it's probably early on. Excuse me, I'm trying to get to the right slide. You know, depending on the system, at least for the RO, you know, you have a $10 to $50 for replacement of the filters, and $100 to $150 for replacement of the RO membranes. For the carbon media, typically you would have to have someone come into the household and change those out for you. I know that the carbon manufacturers all have facilities where they can reactivate carbon and incinerate the PFAS or destroy the PFAS and still reuse the carbon. So, you know, it depends on which system you're talking about.
Okay. For the GAC versus RO systems, if you were looking at meeting 70 PPT or 70 parts per trillion, what would be the cost of treatment per 1,000 gallons of water treated? Did you establish those basic comparisons?
No, we didn't. You know, again, this is preliminary research. We're just looking at, you know, how well do these commercially available systems remove the PFAS. We didn't actually do a demonstration study. I guess, you know, I did a study in Missouri at a Superfund site for lead removal using RO and GAC, and we actually installed 30 systems out of 300, and then we actually got better idea of what all this would cost. But until you do that, you know, you can't really get a definitive answer.
Okay. We did have someone come in with just a clarifying statement with, I believe, something that Steve had just mentioned. And this participant states that it is the Whitefield public drinking water system, not Whitefield. They go on to then say that Air Force also installed a smaller ion exchange system at a mobile home park, and they've operated for a year with no breakthrough of the lead or lag tank. I don't know if either of you are familiar with that work or want to comment on that information.
No, I thought I mentioned that the ion exchange resin system that I saw was wide field. I thought it was wide field and not security. And I guess the other point is I would refer people to, I think, both the state website and the county website. There are links to the various municipalities, and if you want to get specific information on the performance of those systems, again, I was briefed several months ago on what the municipalities are doing, but I'm sure there is more up-to-date information on whether they're using exchange resins, whether they're using activated carbon, and what the influent and effluent results are for the treatment.
Okay, thank you. We do have another water quality question that came in. Somebody noticed that the maximum value of arsenic is above the MCL of 10 parts per billion. They just were curious if your drinking water was being treated for arsenic, and also, they noticed the high fluoride level. Is that water being fluoridated? And they're just looking to see if those particular analytical quali- or chemical qualities would be influencing the treatment.
Okay, the answer is, these were available on the Colorado Department of Health and Environment website. These are the worst case, so I pulled up, things that may not have been in compliance. This is not, typical for that water quality. It's just looking at, out of all the samples taken, these are the worst concentration levels. So to answer your question, I don't think the fluoride would have an impact on the PFAS removal, and the arsenic. It's a metal. The RO system, may be effective for the arsenic removal, but yeah, it's not going to impact the PFAS removal.
Okay. And the last sort of largest group of questions that I have in the queue is centering around future research and research opportunities. So a number of people want to know where EPA is going with future research in this area.
Yeah, Steve mentioned the, study of the resin. Ideally, you would want the manufacturers to come up with their own systems that would work for a household and have them commercially available. I have seen a lot of systems where they combine, they have the anti-exchange resin first, followed by carbon. And I think, there's a lot of opportunities out there for, in the water industry to actually step in and start selling these, because I think a lot of the people with contaminated well water, in these areas give a lot more peace of mind. As far as what we would do, we would rely heavily on what's available. I know the NSF is actually decided not to move forward with the P473. They're actually going to ballot the PFAS contaminants into NSF 53 for health effects for carbon, and then also for NSF 58 for reverse osmosis units. So they're going to treat it much like a lot of other contaminants with the other NSF standards. So ideally, we would continue to try to come up with, at least from a research perspective in the Office of Research and Development, come up with the best available household treatment technology to solve these problems. And it's obvious that it's a moving target. When we started this back in 2016, resin wasn't even on the radar, but now it is. So, I think that's a key area we could move into as far as, assisting homeowners.
Okay. And the final question, I'll sort of group this in there. There have actually been a number of people who have asked about working research with you, that they're going to do research on their own and they'd like to partner with you. So if someone is interested in working with you, what's the best way to reach out to you?
The government typically can develop cooperative research and development agreements with private industry or, anybody who's interested, academia. I think the best way would be for them to email me or Steve to, sort of spell out what kind of research you're thinking of doing, so that we could, take all this seriously moving forward.
Okay, excellent. Any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
Well, Gene, Steve. I would just say that the question was, what is the agency doing? And as far as PFAS goes, it's fair to say that this is an agency priority. There's a lot going on in the research side of things, particularly with what ORD is doing, you know, from a programmatic perspective. We're looking at steps to evaluate the need for an MCL for things like PFOA and PFOS, designating them as hazardous substances, and then developing cleanup recommendations. We're also, you know, that's programmatically, those are a number of the things that are going on. We are doing a lot of research on toxicity components, so I think you'll be seeing new tox values for things like Gen X and PFBS and some of the newer compounds that have come into our sites here more recently. And then just on the analytical side, as Craig mentioned, you know, Region 5 was instrumental in helping us. They're doing a lot in the development of the HPLC methodologies. I think originally we could see something of around 15 compounds in this class of materials that we know contains, you know, upwards of 3,000 or more. So there's a lot to go on the analytical side. We are working on some, you know, assays and other things that are more broadly looking at it. And then we're also looking at, you know, the analytical methodologies for chasing down specific compounds. So there's work there as well. There's work on developing tox values. So there's a lot of opportunities for research, and it's an agency priority, and I think it will continue to be for the foreseeable future.
All right, excellent. With those closing words, let me go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders before we go ahead and officially end today's live broadcast. So the first thing I'd like to do is thank our two speakers for joining us today. I want to thank Steve and Craig for sharing their information on this project. I also want to thank the over 322 individuals who joined us from all over the United States for today's live broadcast. Just walk through a couple of quick reminders here that if you would like to access copies of the presentation content, look for contact information to follow up with Craig or Steve. You'll find all of that available off of the seminar homepage. So it's currently hyperlinked on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. I also shared that with you all directly in the Q&A window. Today's session was recorded, and you'll automatically get an email once an archived version is available. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying that archive, you can still follow the links in the Q&A window and the related URLs window to open up those resources. I'll ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of the delivery that we offered, both the content that we covered as well as the way that we shared today's information. One of the most common questions we get for our webinars as if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While we don't necessarily offer those credit hours, we do offer a certificate for participating in the webinar. Many participants are able to take that certificate along with their registration confirmation and then copies of the materials or a printout of the seminar homepage and get enough credit or documentation for joining so they get credit hours from their own institution. So if you're looking for one of those certificates, you'll be able to access it by filling out the online feedback form. Again, you'll find that on the right side of your screen. Once you fill out the form, make sure you check the box at the bottom to confirm you are here for the entire session or replayed the whole archive. And then once you submit the feedback form, you will immediately have access to a certificate form that you can then either print out or save for your own records. If you happen to have joined in a group of individuals, each person can actually fill out that feedback form on their own, independent of the registration status, to get their own certificate. So again, if you joined with a colleague under their registration, you can fill out the form on your own to get your own certificate. So with that, again, thank you very much to our presenters as well as the live audience who joined us for today's session. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN seminar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.